Ja, ich möchte Sie ganz herzlich heute Abend zu dieser Veranstaltung im Kepler Salon begrüßen. Und das Thema des heutigen Abends sind Männer. Männer sind auch in genügender Zahl hier, damit es eben auch eine gewisse Art von Betroffenheitsreaktion geben kann. Aber es geht diesmal um Männlichkeit aus einer ganz spannenden Perspektive. Es geht um Männlichkeit in der internationalen Führungsschicht. Die Krise der Männlichkeit, die hier zur Debatte steht, ist keine Krise der Männlichkeit in sozial deklassierten Milieus, sondern es ist eine Frage nach sozusagen Männlichkeiten in globalen Führungsinstitutionen, in den Managementabteilungen von Großkonzernen. Und die Referentin, die ich heute Abend ganz herzlich begrüßen möchte, die aus Sydney zu uns gekommen ist, ist Raven Connell von der University of Sydney. Ganz herzlich willkommen. Danke. Sie ist glücklicherweise nicht heute direkt aus Sydney angekommen, sonst würde sie noch viel stärker unter Jetlag leiden, als das vielleicht noch der Fall ist, sondern sie hat schon etwas Zwischenstopp gemacht in London, bevor sie dann in die Kulturhauptstadt gekommen ist, also sozusagen sich ein bisschen aufwärts bewegt, von Metropole zu Metropole. Und Raven ist, würde ich sagen, die wirklich kompetente Auskunftsperson in Fragen sozusagen von der Geschlechterforschung und auch in Fragen sozusagen der Männlichkeitsforschung. Sie beschäftigt sich, wie wir so im Gespräch festgestellt haben, schon seit etwa 30 Jahren mit der Geschlechterforschung in unterschiedlichen Kontexten. Sie hat sehr viel und umfassend dazu publiziert. Zwei von diesen Arbeiten zirkulieren auch hier im Publikum. Sind die zwei letzten Arbeiten, die jetzt gerade rausgekommen sind, ein Buch über Southern Theory, in dem es eine Art Intellectual History, so eine Art Ideengeschichte, Theoriegeschichte der soziologischen Wissens, um Theoriegeschichte soziologischen Wissens geht. Ein zweites Buch, das hier zirkuliert, ist ein Überblick über Genderforschung. Und das Buch, mit dem sie auch weltweit vielleicht am stärksten in Verbindung gebracht wird, ist das Buch über Masculinities, über den gemachten Mann, das 1995 erschienen ist. Und diese Bücher umreißen eigentlich sehr gut so diese vielfältigen Ansatzpunkte in der Auseinandersetzung mit Geschlechterfragen, in ethnografisch-soziologischen Zugriffen ebenso wie in theoretischen Zugriffen. Und ich glaube, wir sind alle sehr gespannt darauf, was Raven uns heute in englischer Sprache zuerst erzählen wird. Und ich bin auch schon sehr gespannt dann auf die Diskussion, die durchaus eben auch in gemischter Form, also als Deutsch-Englisch stattfinden kann. Sie können gerne Fragen in deutscher Sprache stellen. Und wir können das entweder übersetzen und Raven ist auch, sie ist ja auch Polyglott und deshalb auch des Deutschen so weit mächtig, dass sie das auch verstehen kann.
Okay. Well, thank you for the kind words of introduction and thank you for the invitation to be here. I'm honored to be invited and delighted to have the chance of talking to you about an issue that is in some ways an issue of popular culture, but also an issue of research, serious research, and questions of organized knowledge. I want to start by talking about the concept of a crisis of masculinity, and then move on to discuss the little bit of evidence we have about whether that is a concept that can be applied to the men of the ruling class of the dominant social groups in the modern world. Now, there has been talk of some kind of crisis of masculinity for at least 100 years, perhaps more, but I'm aware of such discussions having gone on around 100 years ago. But the talk certainly picked up. It became more enthusiastic and anxious. In the 1970s, essentially as a response to the women's movement, to the new radical feminism of the 1970s, the women's liberation movement, and its uninhibited critique of the practices of men and the social position which men had held. So that women's liberation represented a dramatic challenge to the idea that men had a rightful position of authority and privilege in the world, that we lived in a world where there was, so to speak, just and rightful patriarchy. That was challenged. It was challenged dramatically and effectively. It wasn't the only thing that was happening in the world that changed the pattern of gender relations. There had been for several decades already a profound worldwide shift in patterns of education. I myself feel that the growth over the last 50 or 60 years in women's literacy levels globally and the investment of resources in the education of girls is perhaps the most profound change in gender relations in my lifetime, perhaps in the last century around the world. And that too, globally, has unsettled patriarchy, has unsettled the sense of the rightful position of privilege among men. And we have, in the same generations, a small shift, not a dramatic one, but a small shift in the gender pattern of access to the top levels of economic and political power. So the first woman elected prime minister in the world came to office in 1960 in Sri Lanka, interestingly. And there have now been women heads of government in Israel, Germany. We nearly got one in the United States. In Britain, only one each, of course, but in India, Pakistan. And, of course, in contemporary Latin America, it's happening again. Now, I'm going to show a few images to illustrate the talk. I apologize for the primitive technology here coming to the Kulturhauptstadt Europas. I should at least have a dramatic computer-based system, but I don't. However, here, for what it's worth, is the nearest thing we have in the world at the moment to a feminist in power, Michelle Bachelet in Chile, a socialist leader and an important political breakthrough in that part of the world, in this case in conversation with Lula, president of Brazil, who's not a feminist, but nevertheless, does his best. So we've had in education, in access to organisational power, and in the arenas of popular politics, something of a shift, not a revolution, not the women's revolution that women's liberation hoped for, but something of a shift which has necessarily had consequences for men, because gender is an interactive system. It's not, you know, two boxes, men in a box and women in a box, but is a system of relationships. So major change in one term of the relationship must mean change for the other. And this has led to quite, you know, significant problems about, particularly about men's continuing authority, as we see in a range of settings. I'm sure a number of the people here paid close attention just before Christmas when the current Pope delivered a homily on the subject of gender and basically denounced the concept of gender and the theories of gender. And that, it seemed to me, was, you know, quite a dramatic acknowledgement of a concern by one of the principal religious authorities in the world to the credibility or the sort of debatable acceptance of traditional system of men's authority. And at many levels, there has been cultural attention to the situation of men, changes in the lives of men, and concern about strategies by which men might respond to this situation. This is the cover of a book, a very good book, I might say, one of the best from anywhere in the world, which has collected research on different groups of men in southern Africa since the transition to democracy from the apartheid system. And the cover, although naive in many ways, does nicely call attention to the social turbulence which has affected gender relations in southern Africa and called into question the lives of men in the different ethnic communities in that part of the world. Now, one of the responses to this disturbance around the position of men has been growing research on men's gender, on the gender practices by which masculinity is constructed and changed. And I will, if you will forgive the advertising, mention a book which brings together in a kind of international thematic collection, work in the social sciences around masculinity as they stood in the middle of the decade. So we now have a knowledge base about masculinity and men's position in gender relations and men's responses to that position. And that's the background from which I want to start thinking about this concept of a crisis in masculinity. Because not to make a mystery of it, I'm a crisis skeptic, at least in relation to gender. Economic crisis, yes. Masculinity crisis, maybe. Let's think about it. There is no doubt that the cultural position of men in many societies around the world has been under challenge and is under public debate. And I want to illustrate this with one more image from this quickfire battery of images from a country that in Australia is regarded as not in the forefront of gender democracy. Perhaps wrongly, but anyway, Japan is the country where, you know, there is one of the most remarkable institutionalized, culturally defined patterns of middle-class masculinity, the famous salaryman model, which was created as a cultural pattern early in the 20th century and became hegemonic in Japanese society in the 1950s and 60s at the time of the Japanese economic miracle. Here were the corporate warriors who built the giant, you know, car manufacturing firms, the photography, the technology, high technology firms. In the 1990s, that image of middle-class masculinity, that pattern, came under, you know, very significant critique and debate. What I'm showing you here is the cover of a booklet put out by a group who called themselves Men's Centre Japan. Not sure if you can read it in the top. And they have put out a series of books. This is the 90th, 90. That's not bad. A series of booklets which are intended to provide discussion materials for forums among men grappling with changes in their own lives. I've actually visited that group in Japan, and they are a very impressive, committed group who've tried to take discussions about changing masculinity into the mass media, to set up education programs, counselling, support programs, and so forth. And although such groups everywhere in the world work on a small scale, nevertheless, it's clear that there is a wide debate in Japan about the situation of men, and the image of what in some quarters is called the salaryman escaping has become a kind of cultural image in Japan, with debate about other ways of life for men. Okay, that's one end, the kind of comfortable end of the social scale. But there are also the uncomfortable end, the working class masses of affluent countries, the rural population of developing countries where the story may be different. But here also are sources of debate and suggestions about crisis. In Australia, for instance, we have been angsting over unemployed youth, with concern about ethnic violence arising among young men who aren't properly attached to the economy or the education system. Does this sound familiar? And there's even concern about a potential drift towards racism and a kind of proto-fascist politics, which has appeared in sort of fringe contexts in Australia. And there's some anxiety that this may grow larger and more threatening in the economic recession. So there are different forms of talk about crisis in masculinity. They're usually focused on the public debates about crisis in masculinity are usually focused on the more marginalised, particularly younger men. But as the salaryman story illustrates, the similar kinds of anxieties can occur among or about white-collar workers. So I now want to go right up the social scale and think about that concept as it might work in relation to the really powerful and privileged groups of men, global ruling class, let's say. Now, Here's a picture of the global ruling class. From an American business magazine, Forbes, and it's a joke, of course, a visual joke, as you can see, but it's a nice joke, which actually does capture something of the self-image that elite businessmen, and they nearly are all men, have of themselves. When I say they nearly all are men, there are statistics behind this statement. One of the leading business magazines in the United States publishes each year one of those rich lists for companies, for international companies, the 500, it's called the Fortune 500. So it includes the biggest 500 corporations in the world. And last year, the Fortune 500, when they published the list of the Fortune 500, they had a little inset about women who had risen to the top of Fortune 500 companies. And lo and behold, there was a magnificent number of 10 women who were chief executive officers of Fortune 500 companies around the world. And the magazine thought, this is wonderful, this is a feminist revolution has struck. But they didn't stop to calculate this means actually 2%, which means that 98% of chief executives of Fortune 500 companies are still men. So that's who I want to invite you to think about. The men above the glass ceiling, where it's still very few women actually get up to that level. The executives, the top executives of transnational corporations, the owners of big capital, who are, despite rumour, still overwhelmingly men, except for a smallish number of women, most of whom inherited money from their fathers. And in my thinking about this, I've also been interested in the interplay between the top executives of private sector organisations and the top executives of public sector organisations, that is, the elite levels of the state, both elected and appointed, who, to a significant extent, inhabit the same social world as the top corporate executives, although they don't usually take home anything like as much money. Now, this group is very hard to research. You can't knock at the door and expect Bill Gates to open the door and do an interview with you. He doesn't do that kind of thing, not with your ordinary working social scientist. And most other, seriously powerful and privileged men are equally protected by walls of secretaries, security men. They inhabit a world which is, to a striking degree, physically separated from the world of working class or even middle class white collar workers. You can see this in the privileged areas of major world cities, that there is the very rich and powerful live to a significant extent in gated communities of their own. And we have access to it mainly at a distance through mass media, but also sometimes through leaks of information, through court cases where material spills out, through memoirs of people who've worked with them. Sometimes they write their own autobiographies and spill the beans. Now, a couple of colleagues of mine Mike Donaldson and Scott Poynting have recently published a book called Ruling Class Men. These are Australian sociologists, so the material they've used comes from around the English-speaking world, and the book was actually published a couple of years ago in Europe. What they did was to bring together all the fragments of information they could get from these different sources, from mass media, memoirs, leaks of information and so forth, and try to patch together a kind of ethnography of power, an account of the way of life, the everyday way of life, the way pattern of growing up of the very rich and privileged. It's quite a fascinating exercise. And it becomes clear in that that men of great power and privilege do live a life that in certain ways are quite stressed. For one thing, they're very anxious about someone coming along and taking their money away. So there is a kind of milieu of distrust in this world. It's very difficult for such men to lay themselves open, to make themselves vulnerable to other people, even in their own environment. Family relationships are often stressful and somewhat distant. The pattern of child rearing, which psychoanalysis has taught us to regard as important in understanding social character, this is relatively distant. So a lot of the child care is handed over to employees, to nannies, childcare workers, private school principals, individual tutors and so forth. So the parent-child relationship is likely to be less close, and the result can be, and it's not guaranteed and it's very hard to tell from the evidence exactly how universal these conclusions are, but the picture that is put together from these sources suggests men who are almost obliged by the social relations in which they live, the social patterns surrounding them, to have a powerful sense of their own self-interest, to thin out the sense of obligation, communal relationship to other people. To see even their own families in instrumental terms, for instance, in planning the succession strategies that are quite important to very rich and powerful men. You know, the question, who do I hand the empire to when I retire, as I get old? Do I have an heir coming up? All of those kinds of things are important and difficult for people in this world of privilege. So that's one of the ways that we can assemble some evidence about the state of masculinity among the world's powerful. Another way is to look at the organisations that they are heads of, that they gain their wealth and power from, and study the gender patterns in those organisations, and particularly to study people a little bit down in the organisation from whom the next generation of top leadership might be recruited. Now, we know that organisations are gendered, and there is a whole sociology of gendered organisations out there. And I apologise to anyone who's seen this image before, but I think it's so nice as an indication of the gender regime of even a high technology organization, or at least their what they're willing to show of their gender arrangements to the public, that I can't resist using it. Okay, so we can study the organizations themselves in terms of the gender patterns and see what kinds of pressures those gender patterns are putting on the top leadership, in this case obviously none. Or we can, as I said, we can study the people, so to speak, next in line for power. And that's what I've been doing in a research project I'm involved in at the moment with colleagues in four countries, Australia, Chile, Japan and South Africa, so that we get a bit of a sense of what is happening in different parts of the world economy. And we've been doing life history interviews with people, some women, and but though mostly men, at the middle levels of management who are positioning themselves for a try at the top leadership. And I could spend an hour describing the project to you, of course, but I'll try and do it in 2 minutes. The typical pattern we have found, and this seems to be true of all three countries, Chile, Japan and Australia, South African data is still being collected. There still is a strong conventional division of labour in the families of most of these middle-ranking executives. The men typically have a wife. Typically, the wife is either full-time at home or has a part-time job which can be fitted around the husband's full-time commitment. And that, of course, is crucial in playing an executive role in a globalising economy, because the executive has to be able to travel. And if the executive has childcare obligations, then the multinational corporation will collapse. So they don't appoint people with childcare obligations to the top level unless that person can hand on the childcare obligation to someone else. And basically the men do it to their wives, and where there are women, they employ people to do the housework and the childcare. So they perform the social role of an employer of domestic labour rather than performing domestic labour themselves. That's the predominant pattern. Now, this creates a problem for some of the men. Most of the men seem to accept this very happily, as if women's liberation had never occurred, as if the Pope were not angsting about gender, as if none of that cultural turbulence had occurred. Most of the men think it's their right to be serviced by a wife, and they will be the breadwinner, except that they are bringing in, you know, $500,000 a year of bread, not just an ordinary salary. So they're bringing in the cake as well as the bread. But some of them have changed in their heads, although the social practices in the corporation has not changed around them. And where they have changed is precisely about the question of fatherhood. Because some of them have heard what's been going on in the culture about new models of fatherhood, about engaged fatherhood, about what I've seen remember being described in Mexico as a lovely term, paternidad afectiva. And my Spanish is even worse than my German, but I think it means emotionally engaged fatherhood. So some of these men have heard these stories and they want part of this. So in one or two of our interviews, we've encountered men who really are in a state of crisis because they have realised that they cannot be engaged fathers and high-powered corporate executives at the same time. Well, there's a lot of women out there who could have told them that a long time ago, but they are discovering it for themselves, and it's hard. It really is hard because the social expectations around them are telling them, you know, get on, earn the next $500,000 next year and go for the top. And if they do that, then fatherhood is gone. I mean, they're just not there for the children and will be even less there for the children in future. So some of these men are in a very difficult personal space and could go either way. It would be very... I would like to re-interview some of these people later on. The other really interesting point that's come out of some of these interviews is about homosexuality and homophobia. It's a convention in most recent discussions about mainstream masculinity or hegemonic masculinity, the culturally dominant form of masculinity in Western culture, whatever quite that means, that to be properly masculine is to reject homosexuality, to be homophobic. And you know, in many cases that is indeed true. But some of the men we've interviewed are actually homosexual. Not only that, they're out. They're gay and out, and corporate executives in significant corporations that are significant players in the transnational economy. And that to me is extremely interesting. One cannot imagine that a generation ago. Now, it may be that these men will not make it quite to the top. It may be that they can't be sent to the corporation's branch in Saudi Arabia. So there may be some limits on their corporate careers. But in other respects, an out gay man is not a bad proposition for a transnational corporation if it means that he doesn't have childcare obligations, and especially if it doesn't mean that he has a long-term partner who is, so to speak, embedded in a particular culture, he may actually be the perfect transnational executive. So there's an interesting kind of secularization, if you like, going on because of the technical requirements of running transnational corporations, of having that globally mobile elite labour force for your top executives, which may actually change the sexual culture of very powerful groups of men in the future. I mean, it's a possibility. It's not foregone conclusion, but it's interesting. So let me draw this to a close. I'll just put up my last picture, which is, since we're having a global financial crisis, here's a banker, so that we can all hate him. An Australian banker, as it happens. But they're all the same, really. You can see the pinstripes. Okay, is there anything like a crisis going on in these men's world? On the whole, I think no. There is a crisis in a few of these men's individual lives, and the crisis is about, can they, with some new consciousness about fatherhood, fit into this very powerful social machine of the transnational corporation, which requires them to be a different kind of person? So there would be a kind of really a critical decision that such men have to make about, by the time they're about 35 years old, as to whether they're going to go for this or not. But beyond that, it doesn't seem to me that we're looking at a situation of crisis. We're looking at a situation where a strongly institutionalised pattern of power is adapting a bit under pressure under the pressure of having to deal with multiple cultures, under the pressure of new institutional demands, particularly that of running transnational organisations. Not an easy thing to do. And out of that will come some adaptations in dominant forms of masculinity. Perhaps, I would guess, there will be an opening towards gay men, an opening towards a larger number of women being allowed into the top levels. Particularly, I think that will be driven by the current financial crisis, because the institutional solution, at least as it's unfolded so far, the institutional solution to the financial crisis is a tighter alliance between the state and corporate capital. And that will bring together the elites of the corporate world and the state more tightly. And the state, of course, has a substantially higher representation of women at the top level. It's still a minority, but the state is much better at gender equity, gender equity in the workplace, than the corporation is. And I think that will also create pressure to shift the more intransigent pattern of patriarchy that currently is still found right at the top levels of the corporate world. I think that is going to shift over the next generation, but it won't be fast, it won't be a revolution. When we think of its implications for gender equality in the rest of the economy, it's not necessarily a good sign, because we also know from research on women in management that when a minority of women get to the top levels of organised corporate power, they work as managers very much the way the men do. They manage, in the words of a lovely piece of sociological research on this, they manage like a man. So that's my story. As you can see, much of it based on Australian material with a little sprinkling from other parts of the world. And the question I want to ask you is, what's going on here? What do you see looking at groups of men at the top levels of corporate or political power in this part of the world that might suggest either movement or absence of movement in the gender patterns among the powerful in Europe? Over to you.
But before we collectively answer this question, let me thank you very much for this intriguing and fascinating talk. And there will be a microphone, I think two, passing around. Die Diskussion wird auch aufgezeichnet. Es ist dann im Internet verfügbar als MP3-Datei. Und deshalb ist es auch wichtig, dass alle Wortmeldungen eben auch mit Mikrofon aufgezeichnet werden. The problem is, when I start now, I can't really respond to a question. I just wanted to raise another question. But maybe we can just, while you collectively all think about answering the question of Raven, I just step in and try to get some response to a curiosity of mine that arose in a conversation that we had before about masculinities and a new study of man. I think it's quite obvious that gender research was first on women, but always also on men, but differently. And I think what you said in the conversation that we had before found it quite interesting and very illuminating, that man, as the kind of the powerful, the patriarch, have always been a kind of a point of reference in these earlier gender studies on women. Now you are moving back to the leading figures, the kind of the patriarchs again, but in a different way. And maybe you could just say a couple of words about the difference in dealing with the patriarchs.
The difference is partly a matter of consciousness, I think, and partly a matter of context. So when the women's liberation movement generated a research program, it was in tandem with a critique of existing knowledge in the social sciences, the natural sciences, and the humanities, which were bodies of knowledge that had overwhelmingly been created by men, reflected men's point of view, but did so without awareness. So, you know, history, natural science, philosophy were, if you like, men's studies, but unthematized. So that was the critical moment of the new feminism. But the positive project of knowledge was to fill the huge gap that patriarchal knowledge systems had left, that is to correct the absence of women, women's subjectivity, women's experience, and women's practice from the whole domain of knowledge. Therefore, the project, at least in the English-speaking world, was initially called Women's Studies. Now, when that project had been underway and had gained traction, as we say, had gained a certain amount of momentum, was producing important results, was reshaping whole fields of knowledge, anthropology, social history and so forth, sociology, it became apparent that that was not a complete answer to the task of developing an analysis of gender. And in that moment, I guess, systematic studies of men returned, but now men as gendered and masculinity as social practice, symbolization and so forth. So what I'm talking about now, if you like, is another step in that project of knowledge, which, having gained some perspective on the social and cultural making of masculinities, is now very much concerned with the consequences, the implications and the dynamics, and that's what's led me back to that rather old, rather traditional style of social science, where you study up, study the power holders in order to understand the system of power.
Hello. I very much enjoyed your presentation. I just want to ask whether you think it's a good idea, due to this financial crisis, a lot of arguments turn around women are better managers because they aren't so much risk-taking than men, also here in Europe. And I'm like, okay, they're rebuilding difference arguments. So I'm thinking, Do you think we have to be careful about this line of argument?
Well, yes, very definitely so. We really should be aware of what the psychological research on psychological differences between women and men say. There is a vast amount of myth-making about this subject. And in fact, you know, when the actual psychological research is is put together, the differences, psychological differences between men as a group and women as a group are remarkably small, and in many areas really not there at all. So I frankly don't think there's much reason to think that men are, you know, generally speaking, risk takers to a much greater extent than women. And I think there's a kind of back formation from the social division of labour because men have been allocated, you know, tasks like being a soldier or being a miner, which are actually, you know, seriously risky kinds of occupations. It's then sort of in a kind of reverse logic being assumed that they must be risk-taking people in order to go into that. Now, of course, until the advent of modern antiseptic techniques, for a woman to get pregnant was serious risk-taking. I mean, you put your life at risk. So my great-grandmother died in childbirth, and that happened to a great many women before modern antisepsis. And still does in many parts of the world. I mean, the rate of perinatal mortality in Central Africa is dismaying, even now. It's one of the Millennium Development Goals that is not being achieved. So, yeah, there's risk and risk. I think the terms of... I've heard that argument too, of course, it's popular, but the terms are actually wrong. The terms of the argument are wrong. And there's also evidence, as I was mentioning, that when women do get into top levels of management, they behave very much like the men do. And the reason for that is not hard to see. I mean, what options are open to managers are very powerfully constrained by the corporate setting, the competition, the kinds of things that the economists indeed talk about. And any very faint psychological predisposition of women to be more, to be less risk-taking, if there is any difference there at all, is unlikely to have a large effect in that world of very powerful social and economic constraints. So.
Referring to your question, how is it in Austria? Talking about statistics, one statistic I found very interesting was once a year in a magazine called Die Industrie, they're listed the 1,000 best connected top level business people. Among the 1,000 are 60 women, so I think the figures are similar. What was completely new for me was hearing about out gay men, something I have not heard in Austria so much among top-level business people. Maybe it's also the Catholic background. What I'm very curious about is on the 14th, I think, we will have... somebody from Norway here, because Norway seems to have an interesting strategy in having a quota among top business people. Maybe you know something about it.
I'm not really up to date, but you're right, it's a very interesting case because the Norwegian state had to intervene to change gender relations in business. Some 15 years ago, it was actually a little more than 15, it was right at the beginning of the 1990s, the American Congress set up an inquiry called the Glass Ceiling Commission, which was to look at why there weren't more women and black men at the top levels of the corporate world in the United States. And they came up with the, you know, conventional set of explanations about that you might expect from a congressional inquiry about how there were certain barriers to entry and how there wasn't enough mentoring and so on and so forth. And the basic recommendation that they made was that there needed to be more women and black men at top levels of management because, get this, it would be good for business. And why, and how would it happen? Well, it would happen by a change of attitude on the part of existing management because they would see this was a way to make more profit. But that's what they had been doing, trying to do for the last 200 years, was make more profit. And the result so far was 95% men to 97% men, 95% white, and so on. And by that calculation, I think they were going to get gender equity and racial equity about the arrival of the next millennium. Yeah, that's what happened in, you know, without state intervention, essentially nothing. So the Norwegian state, which has been significantly impacted by women, and they've had cabinets, they've had, you know, women as political leaders of all the Norwegian major parties at the same time, notably, and a powerful presence of women in the political elite. They legislated to require corporations to have, I think it's 40%, isn't it? 40% women in the board, at board level. And that's created movement. I mean, if you pass a law and have penalties, then something happens. Now, what will happen as a result of that, though, is, you know, open to question. It may be that what happens is that a small group of elite women with university degrees in business and connections to existing wealthy families will suddenly get a whole lot of board appointments among themselves and will become kind of network stars within the networking system of board membership. And that may be all that happens as a result of that legislation. Of course, they hope there will be a trickle-down effect, and perhaps there will, but we have yet to see. I don't know. Is there anyone here who's more up to date than I am and knows what's been happening in the last year or so? Up there in the cold, Willa.
Yes, I just have attended two conferences in the northern European countries in February, and I came to learn that the Norwegian government has immediately put up an evaluation project to measure the enterprises if there is indeed, in a period of 2 or 3 years, more economic progress in the companies where this quota has been fulfilled as in the companies where there are less women. So this seems to stress the thesis that it's a difference theory behind it. But on the other hand, it's more contradictory, I think, because in the northern states I had the impression that enabling women to follow a career or enabling men to follow a paternidad affectiva is also related to a discourse of civil society. And if men or women are banned from following to these paths, then they cannot fully express themselves as citizens. And therefore, the Norwegian Minister for Gender Equality has said, it was just, we have this principle of equality, and if we don't have women in an adequate proportion, then this is hurting our principles. And this was convincing to our government. In at last. So this was I think this is and this discourse of civil society and to express yourself as a citizen to have these possibilities maybe is not so much needy of a theory of difference. Although, of course, beforehand there must we have instated a difference of some kind somewhere, but it does not have to be a substantial one or an essentialist one or so. So I would say it's there is this hint that there is that there are some groups that are thinking of difference, and now more women shall pay out, shall pay for, or it should be. Be an economic success, and on the other hand, it's much more open and complex and diffuse.
Yeah. That's interesting. You can see the argument from civil society and from the idea of a good life that is shared between women and men, and you can see that gaining a grip at the level of a country like Norway. But when you move into the space, the transnational space of big multinational capital, it may be different. I have read a fascinating and rather frightening paper about the gender patterns in the management of a bank that was set up by a merger of banks from Norway, Denmark, Sweden, and I think Finland, so not long ago. Now, those are all countries with quite strong gender equality regimes in international terms. And they're up there near the top of the gender empowerment index that the United Nations Development Programme publishes. Somewhat weird statistics, but anyway. So these are countries with good gender equality regimes. And you would think if you take a bank from each and merge them, you should get an institution with pretty strong gender equality ideas. So the scientists who did this research went and interviewed the executives of the merged bank to see if they found among them the consequences of the Nordic gender equality culture. And the answer was they didn't. Most of them had reproduced not the gender equality regime of their homeland, but the breadwinner housewife managerial masculinist model of United States and transnational corporate management. That was what had happened. Now, that's one case, but it's a very striking one, suggesting the power of the constraints that operate in this world of transnational capital against, you know, cultural change, maintaining those older patterns in a new context.
In your description of the people in power, they live, some are separated and they know their own interests very well. So this is actually the definition of tyranny. So are we living in a global tyranny?
Well, what do people think? I think there's something in that, but a very disorganized tyranny, and one which is not showing itself to have a great grip of events at the moment. But from the point of view of much of the world's population, economic events are out of control, are not accessible to the exercise of reason or popular control. One of the most interesting social scientists I know of anywhere in the world is a Mexican anthropologist, cultural studies person called Néstor García Campini, one of the people who invented the idea of cultural hybridization, and a fascinating writer on the modern mega city. And Campini wrote an essay a few years ago about Latin American culture, in which he remarked that under the neoliberal global regime, the kinds of decisions that are accessible to popular debate and popular pressure are the relatively unimportant ones. And the major decisions about the way the world is going are increasingly taken in forums that are simply removed from public gaze, and where you know, there is no popular access at all. And I think he's largely right. I mean, it's a slight overstatement, but there is a sense in which the public arena of politics and economic decision making is essentially a show. In Australia, for instance, key decisions about economic policy on the part of the national government are largely taken through a process of economic modelling using computers. Okay, we all hear about economic modelling. So this is actually vital information. If you want to play a role in economic decision making, at least in relation to the state, corporations, of course, are more hidden again, but in relation to the state, where we supposedly have an elected government, then you need this information. Can you get the information of the economic models? No. You can't even get it through the courts. We have a Freedom of Information Act, and people have tried to get the economic modelling through the Freedom of Information. It's denied. It is legally impossible to get the crucial information on which a democratic economic decision-making would be based in a country that, you know, is supposed to be democratic. And I think that's very common, actually. I think that is very common. I think it has become extraordinarily difficult to exercise real democratic control over strategic decision-making, either in government or in the corporate economy. And I have to say, worried about the way that the response to the current financial meltdown has unfolded, that the main strategy of response to it is not to address the substantive problem with which the meltdown began. That was the crisis of working class housing in the United States. That's where, you know, what triggered the so-called toxic loan problem. They don't even talk about that as part of the crisis anymore. The crucial moves are to bring about a closer integration of the policy-making levels of the state with the policy-making levels of the corporate world through regulation, government control, loans, nationalisation of banks, and so forth. And that seems to me to be a response which is simply not opening the issues to popular scrutiny or popular control. I mean, it's not a democratic response to the economic crisis. For all the talk that we're bringing back Marx.
To the Austrian situation, just a few words. One thing is that, of course, we are living in a society with the male breadwinner and the female co-earner model, I would say, in Austria, because we got a lot of women, employed women, but yeah, most of them are co-earners. That means they take care for their families and do part-time jobs. This is one thing. The other thing is that we got around 3.2 or up to 3.7% fathers leave in Austria. So this is the other thing. And we got this strategy, gender mainstreaming, as you might know, which we thought could be a challenge for men as well. So we don't just support women. We got these women supportive measures. We support men taking care for their children. We thought this could be a chance in Austria. implementing gender mainstreaming and making getting caring masculinities out of it, but it doesn't really work. And my question is, could it be that the principle of our economy, the Homo economicus, is an androgyne one and a masculine one? And because you said before, once a woman gets into a management position, in some ways she will become a man. So, this is a question. With gender mainstreaming, we try to get women in management positions, but with a homo economicus as an economical principle, which is masculine, we make them, they will in the end come up as a man. I mean, what do you say to that?
That raises so many questions. Yes, there is, I think, a strong sense in which a particular version of Homo economicus is masculinized. Now, that is not because our brains are hardwired so that men are producers and women are consumers, or men always go out and hunt mammoths and bring back the food and women remain in the cave looking after the babies and all of that. It's absolute nonsense. In the ethnographic record, there are many societies where women collectively produce more food, for instance, than men do. And that's usual in hunter-gatherer societies. But economic processes are so deeply gendered that they are genuinely difficult to change. And if you can't simply change a set of what do the economists call it, policy settings in the economy, and expect massive gender consequences to result. What you can expect is that where sort of cultural, economic and political processes are pushing in the same direction, then you can get changes which may really quite significantly shift gender relations, for instance, in families. Now, a really interesting example of this is in Latin America, in some parts of Latin America. Much of Latin America, as people may know, was in a kind of economic crisis in the 1980s. It's often called the lost decade in Latin America. Crisis of the old model of growth, military dictatorships here and there. The International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, moved in. There was a loans crisis. They brought in the structural adjustment programs, heavy-handed neoliberalism. And as a result of the neoliberal resolution of the crisis, in many countries which got World Bank loans and had to undertake a structural adjustment program, social services were cut. Especially services to mothers and children were regarded as soft options, so they were cut. education, so forth, all of this was affected. But one of the consequences was, in certain significant parts of Latin America, there was a sudden economic pressure on mothers to become employed, sometimes because fathers had ceased to be employable, men's jobs had vanished, or simply that there was such a dire situation that every adult had to go looking. And there's some interesting ethnographic work that has traced the consequences of neoliberal restructuring in societies which had a very strongly gendered model of motherhood that separated motherhood from employment. And the consequence of all of these things working together was that the image of motherhood has begun to change, with the good mother increasingly being regarded as someone who can earn a wage and support the children through the economy. So the good mother is no longer someone who stays at home with the children, but someone who can support the children by paid work. And that fascinates me as an example of, you know, something operating at a very profound level of emotion, self-image, cultural definition, in response to a set of political and economic changes, turbulence, social disruption and so forth. So if that can happen, you know, in the dire case, perhaps also it should be able to happen in less dire circumstances if somehow the society could organise itself to demand it.
Yeah. I'm not so familiar with social studies than you, and so it is quite difficult for me to follow your discussion and also your presentation, but I only want to confirm if I got the core message. You were searching, or you did researches, if there is a crisis of masculinity in the ruling class and top management of corporations, and have I understood correctly, you did not find any signs for a crisis of masculinity. Main point is the really high class is not easy to research, and the middle class, here you found only a minority has some conflicts with fulfilling their fatherhood and pushing their career. So is this the key message?
Yes, that's a central part of it. But when I talked about the men who were facing a kind of crisis of choice in their own lives between career and fatherhood, these are men who are already quite privileged. They're not the middle class in the sense of middle income. They're high income men who are not yet right at the top, but could become so in the next 10 years if they choose not to be good fathers but to be good executives. They may come out right at the top.
Well, really, one thing that I think that I found quite interesting, you completed your argument with kind of a look at the relationships between state and corporations. And one way to look at this might also, in a sense, also to question the impact of these constraints of international organizations and living circumstances and the obligations to move, would be to look at senior state officials in the diplomatic service. Do you find the same kind of pattern here with a low percentage of women present and similar kind of constraints in terms of family obligations, the outsourcing of family obligations?
I haven't myself got case studies of that group, but there is a bit of research on that. And at least until fairly recently, yes, that's exactly the pattern, that the great majority of diplomats were men. And if they were married, as significant numbers of them are, then the wife was expected to move with the career or to keep the home fires burning and bring up the children at home. So a very similar structural pattern. Now, how that has been affected by equal opportunity in the public sector, I'm not quite sure, but I think there would be more pressure in the public sector, in public sector organizations, than in the corporate sector, actually to do, you know, to move more women through to elite levels. I remember some discussions in United Nations circles, however, which argued this had not gone very far. I mean, the United Nations is interesting because, I mean, we sometimes think of it as a world parliament, but it's not. It's actually a club of nation states staffed by diplomats, so that the United Nations actually is full of diplomats. And there were some, you know, quite familiar-looking statistics about the numbers of men and women at the elite levels of United Nations organisations. Those two are overwhelmingly men. But they are under challenge, as they would be in the public sector of any of the, at least, richer states who are members of the United Nations. So there is a very effective bunch of what we in Australia call femocrats, feminist bureaucrats, in the United Nations who are pushing for reform of United Nations organisations. And they have a little bit of traction, they have a little bit of leverage, not just because of the principle of gender equality, but because United Nations organisations have always been concerned with cultural and regional diversity. So you get a kind of bargaining going on in United Nations organisations to make sure you have someone from Africa, someone from Latin America, someone from East Asia, someone from the Arab world and so forth in any given committee or organisation. So the mechanisms by which you try to produce some measure of equality in organisations are really quite familiar and can be used to try to achieve gender equality. But again, you know, whether there will be organisational pressure behind this is, you know, always open to question, since if the constituent governments don't press for reform, then there's no political force that will produce it.
Yep. I'd like to ask you one more question. One thing was very interesting, what you said when you talked about homosexual men working on the middle management level or upper management mm-hmm. level, and especially in companies, in transnational companies. So talking in your terms, in the terms of your theory, would you say that because hegemonic masculinity is a relational term, isn't it? Would you say that homosexual men could become, in a globalized economy, a hegemonic masculinity? I mean, would you say that?
That's a very interesting question. I mean, it's quite a dramatic possibility. I would not expect homosexual men to become the hegemonic group in transnational corporate management. But I do think there is a possibility that the hegemonic masculinity of the global corporate world will adjust, will shift itself so as to be open to gay men to inhabit that form of masculinity too. So, I mean, the notion of hegemonic masculinity is always something which is open to contestation and change. It's not a fixed pattern of masculinity. And in my judgment, this is one of the most likely changes to happen right now. But it will be resisted also because, you know, there is still a great deal of organised homophobia out there, including in the diplomatic world.
We have still time for one last question, and if I'm lucky, no one of you asked it, so I'm. It's left for you because there is one issue that I actually wanted to address at the end, and it's In a sense, if one talks about the crisis of masculinity, especially with from your viewpoint, I think my kind of curiosity would be if you see this newly emerging kind of essentialist theories of gender difference, like in the neurosciences, genetics, as a kind of a response to that or related to that. Is there a kind of a tendency to reify gender differences in order to secure this kind of differences, to secure also masculinity?
I think there is definitely a kind of a cultural force behind the upsurge of talk about brain sex and biological difference and, you know, genetically determined difference between men and women. And I might mention something that I mentioned in our prior discussion that happened. Can I recommend everybody go down someday, go down, cross the bridge and go into the Science Museum on the other side of the bridge. Sorry, what's the name?
Electronic Arts Museum.
Thank you. And go down to the main hall, which I did today. And on the right-hand side, you'll see in one of the panels a display with two children's toys. One is a fierce-looking military-style robot, and the other is a cuddly baby doll. And guess which is for boys and which is for girls? No idea. And the written up above it is the scientific explanation of this, which runs roughly. We used to think that boys and girls' differences in preferred toys was a matter of social construction. But now, scientists think that this is genetically determined, it's biologically determined, and it's connected. The evolutionary psychologists have revealed that it's connected with mate selection. And I thought, no, I can't believe this. I mean, evolutionary psychology, for people who don't know it, is a fancy term for what used to be called sociobiology. Mm-hmm. It's a mass of speculation with almost no factual basis at all. And here it is, you know, being offered as, you know, scientifically revealed truth to all the hundreds of kids who flood in there being excited about new developments in science. So, yeah, there's cultural anxiety here. Most of the people who, you know, promote this kind of stuff are men, most of them fairly conservative in general social outlook. Doubtless some of them think it is real science. Some of them certainly spend a lot of time writing it and researching it. But, yeah, I'm inclined to read it as a sign of a wider cultural anxiety about gender change and reconstruction. I don't think it's particularly a defence of a particular version of masculinity, certainly not the masculinity of the elite, because these, you know, the people I've been talking about, you know, you're multimillionaires and corporate heavies, they don't care about this stuff. It's trivial business for them. They're not really interested in that. They've got levers of power in their hands and they're anxious to make their systems work. But there are many other people who, you know, can express, find, you know, such cultural forms for expressing anxieties about gender change, I think.
Thank you very much, Robin, for this, also for the discussion and the talk.
Thanks.